I'm Mr. Sinclair. This is Ideas. And we're aboard the Topaz out of Plymouth, England, en route to Quebec. Among the passengers, a young woman about to begin a new chapter in her life in a new land.
Topaz, Tuesday, 21 May, 1799. Latitude 46, longitude 37. Dearest brother, I shall be much rejoiced to arrive at Quebec, for though everything is made as comfortable as possible here, terra firma is infinitely to be preferred. We long to get to the banks of Newfoundland to catch some fresh codfish. I find the ocean much less terrific than I had imagined, and I have never had any fears in regard to drowning or storms. Captain Church has fresh bread baked every morning, which is a great luxury. I have never eaten any salt meat except tongue and ham, and then only by preference.
Elizabeth Amherst Hale was 25 years old, an English gentlewoman and a bride. At her side aboard the Topaz was her husband, John Hale, Deputy Paymaster General of the British forces at Quebec. John had already spent some time in the colony, but for Elizabeth, this journey was her first trip away from her beloved England.
Write me particularly how you all do and how matters are going in all quarters. Oh, pray tell Lady A to send me word about my heaths and other flowers. Ever yours most affectionately, Elizabeth. P.S. Mr. Hale desires his love.
John and Elizabeth Hale were leaving behind a continent at war. A war between those old and familiar enemies, England and France. The Hales knew the conflict might easily leap across the ocean to embroil the Canadas. In fact, only 3 days out of Plymouth, the Topaz spotted a French lugger and sailed in pursuit, guns firing. But the Topaz lost her quarry. The journey continued peacefully, and the Hales arrived at Quebec, unaware that they would live out the rest of their lives in this new land. In this Ideas program, we're going to hear some of the hundreds of letters Elizabeth and John wrote from Quebec to Elizabeth's brother William in England. William's letters have been lost, but Elizabeth and John's paint a rare and compelling portrait of Quebec as it was nearly two centuries ago, seen through the eyes of the colony's English ruling class. And they show how one aristocratic family came to see its future not in England, but in this new country. This program was prepared by Toronto writer Sandra Martin and University of Western Ontario history professor Roger Hall.
Elizabeth knew more about Quebec than most newcomers. She had grown up hearing first-hand reports about her new home from her uncle, Lord Geoffrey Amherst. He was the former commander-in-chief of the British Army. During the Seven Years' War, he had commanded British forces in North America. General James Wolfe, the man who defeated the French at Quebec, had been one of Amherst's subordinates. And it was Lord Amherst who received New France's surrender in 1760 in the city of Montreal. This event meant a great deal to him. And years later, when he was back in England, he named his estate in Kent Montreal. It was here, at this very English Montreal, that Elizabeth and her older brother William Pitt Amherst lived after their parents died. As children, Elizabeth and William were inseparable. As adults, they were divided by oceans and continents. She raised a family and built a home in Quebec. He pursued a brilliant diplomatic career that culminated in his appointment as Viceroy of India. Over the years, they kept in touch through letters that are intimate, ambitious, gossipy, and sometimes heartbreaking.
Chateau, Quebec, 22nd July, 1799. My own dearest brother, how I wish you could see our pretty house and garden. It is just like an English one. Someday you may be tempted to come and see for yourself. we can give you a very comfortable room and most hearty welcome. There is one circumstance which at first seems odd. Every house is obliged by law to have a ladder on each side of every chimney in case of fire, as the roofs are for the most part made of wood. When we first landed, I observed how much mischief had been done by the long frost, as the ladders gave the appearance that everyone was repairing the roofs of their houses. If it was not for the Atlantic Ocean separating us from our dearest friends, we should really have nothing to wish for but a continuation of our present happiness. Quebec, 5 September 1799. Dearest brother, I had two female Yankees to dine with me not long ago. When we went upstairs after dinner, I left them alone for a few minutes. On my return, I found them busily opening every drawer and cupboard that was not locked and examining the contents. They did not seem in the least confused on my coming in, but continued their search and asked me the price of many things. Their idle curiosity is beyond anything I ever met with. If you happen to leave letters on the table and go out of the room, they will make no scruple about reading them. They have a sad custom of coming down to breakfast nearly as soon as they get out of their beds. In hot weather, they frequently appear without stockings and with their shoes down at heel, wearing a loose kind of dirty bedgown with their nightcap still on. It never enters their heads to wash or comb themselves till after breakfast.
Elizabeth was very conscious of her status and family background, and while she was willing to put up with the unseemly behavior of the odd ill-bred Yankee, she made it her business to ensure that her family had appropriate social links with people of equal standing in her new community.
We dined at Bishop Mountain's the other day. They are uncommonly pleasant people, particularly Mrs. Mountain. We are next-door neighbors, and Mrs. M. says that by and by, when I may not feel well enough to venture out on cold nights and may want a little society, she will come in and sit with me at any time.
It may seem prescient of Mrs. Mountain to know that Elizabeth would feel unwell by and by, but Elizabeth was bound by her upbringing and class to write in polite code, even to her brother, and this was her delicate way of telling him that she was pregnant.
Quebec, 13 January, 1800. My dear Lord, I have the pleasure to inform you that your sister was safely delivered of a son on the 9th. She is so well and in such good spirits that if the old women would let her, she would now be out of bed. The child is healthy, and as she means to nurse it herself, no doubt it will continue so. Your sister will write herself with the details of all the child's beauties and perfections. I shall therefore proceed to matters of less moment, though not altogether uninteresting. There is a very snug employment in the country, which I should be very glad to lay my hands upon, whenever the present possessor lets go his hold. The appointment is that of Receiver General of Lower Canada, now held by Mr. Henry Caldwell. He is near 70 years old, and I am told he has a sore leg, as black as my hat. I would not wish you to ask a favour on my account, where it might be attended by anything unpleasant to yourself. I only point out the object, which is a salary of 500 a year, and I leave the rest to your own discretion.
John Hale was an ambitious man with well-placed friends and family. On an earlier Canadian posting, he had served with His Royal Highness, the Duke of Kent. And Elizabeth's brother William was well connected with the imperial authorities at home in England and had inherited the title of Lord Amherst on his uncle's death. It was only natural that John and Elizabeth would ask family for help in furthering John's career. Family helping family was typical of the time. Susan Houston teaches history at York University.
I think family is the key. I mean, it was the key for the aristocrats. It was the key for the cousins and second cousins and third cousins of the royal family. And it was the key for the upper middle class of the squirearchy and the new money of late 18th century British society, and your obligations to your family and an extended family, not just your brothers and your sisters and your mother and father, but a network of family was very important. It was the social cement. And you advanced their fortunes in every conceivable way, not just a obvious letter of introduction. Well, that was very important, but there would be innumerable opportunities to drop the name of a family member or remind somebody of a family connection, or not just in public affairs, the private world of women and women's networks and associations served the same purpose of advancing the fortunes or even just whatever the person wanted to have happen next week. This was part and parcel of life.
But no matter how willing and generous, there were some things that even the best and most prosperous of families could not fix.
Quebec, 3 September, 1800. My dear Lord, I am grieved to be under the necessity of preparing you for the probable loss of your little nephew, Geoffrey. He has always been a very delicate child, though extremely lively and intelligent. The excessive heat of this summer has brought on a bowel complaint which has left a debility in his powers of digestion, and he is evidently going off gradually. Your sister is in the greatest affliction, and is in one of those states when I believe reason is not to be listened to.
Elizabeth was inconsolable in her grief that autumn, but by Christmas her spirits began to lift, and she was once more anxious to plunge into the novelties of life in her new country.
Quebec, 29 December, 1800. Dearest brother, who says that Canada is a cold country? On Christmas Eve, we were obliged to put our door open, and for several nights we have slept without a counterpane. There is very little snow on the ground, and the weather is quite like an English April. I have given up going out any more at present, as the thaw has made the ground so very slippery that people tumble about like ninepins. In truth, it is much too warm for the season, and we begin to have some apprehensions about our winter's provisions. I must tell you a good contrivance in our yard. The cow is obliged to be housed all winter and has an apartment in the stable, and immediately over her ladyship's back we have a very large wooden cage which the poultry inhabits. The warmth from the cow keeps them sufficiently warm during the coldest weather. I think you must be tired of poultry, but I have very little to write upon at this dead time of year.
Quebec, 7 January, 1801. My dear Lord, I have the pleasure to inform you that your sister was safely delivered of a daughter at 2 o'clock this morning and is now quite well. She had felt herself a little unwell yesterday morning. She assembled all the old women and sent me to sleep in another room. But she continued quite well till we separated at 10 to go to bed. I knew nothing of the matter till I was called at 3, and found the child dressed and sucking away very heartily. At the desire of the Duke of Kent, the name will be Sophia Amelia. His Royal Highness is to be sponsor.
Quebec, 14 February, 1801. My dearest brother, I can assure you that your little niece is a very great beauty. What is still better, perfectly healthy and quiet. Sophia is very fair and fat, with a double chin and dimples in each cheek, dark blue eyes, a remarkably pretty mouth, not like her mamma's, and a very fine head of hair.
Quebec, 14 August, 1801. My dear Lord, I am sure you will grieve to hear that we have again been unfortunate and have lost poor little Sophia. She died yesterday after a sudden illness of only 2 days. proceeding, as the surgeon pronounces, from the irritation always attending the cutting of teeth. Your sister is in the greatest affliction. Quebec, 11 December 1801. My dear Lord, your sister was safely delivered of a boy on the 6th and is as well as possible. The boy is a strong, fine child and gives us better prospects, I hope, for the future. Your sister continued in perfect health till the last, and the night before her delivery, she played at casino with a small party at home till 10 o'clock, and all was over by 6 the next morning.
This boy was also named Geoffrey, after his great-uncle, the field marshal. He was the first of 9 Hale children to survive into adulthood. In all, Elizabeth gave birth to 12.
You know, the chances of a child dying shortly after birth or as a youngster cut across all social classes. You couldn't protect your children from consumption or accident or drowning or falling off a horse or whatever. The mortality rates were devastating. But 12 children was quite a lot for anyone in any social strata. If you were a laboring family, if you were of common folk, particularly if you lived in the countryside, obviously children were hands. They could help in the fields. They could help around the house. If you were an early factory worker, if you were trying to do a little spinning on the side, obviously the children were an asset, and that partly explains the great growth spurt in the British population at the second half of the 18th century, because ordinary people could see perfectly well the advantage of having more children. Eventually, people realized that children cost money, especially if you want to school them and this kind of thing. The aristocracy and the upper middle class, which the Hales represent, were less, obviously, the economic advantages of large families were not, that wasn't the point. By the end of the 18th century, it seems pretty clear that affection in families, the caring for children, the caring of husband for wife and vice versa, and their caring for their children was an important part of this family atmosphere. But as I say, 12 is a lot.
The Hale family's early years in Quebec coincided with a period of great uncertainty. Revolutionary France and Imperial Britain had been at war since 1793, and although the colony was separated from the main belligerents by an ocean, war was never far from their thoughts. The conflict, with occasional ceasefires, dragged on until the decisive Battle of Waterloo in 1815. One of these interludes, the so-called Peace of Amiens, occurred in 1802. Like war, the effects of this peace were felt an ocean away.
18 April, 1802. My dearest brother, many windows here are filled with lighted candles. Notwithstanding that this is a garrison town, and many must feel a great diminution of income and the loss of all chance of promotion for some years in consequence of the peace, rejoicings are very great. Even the barracks are illuminated. We are all very anxious to know what changes the peace will make in our military society. We are much in want of some agreeable, well-behaved young women here. The girls are most of them great fools, and there is really no possibility of being intimate with more than 3 houses in the place.
This respite from war gave Elizabeth pause to think about the lack of suitable society in the colony. It also gave John time to take care of some business for his brother-in-law. When William inherited Lord Amherst's title, he also inherited his property, and this included a vast, scattered land holding in Canada called the Jesuit Estates. This land had belonged to the Jesuit order in Canada, but had been awarded to Lord Geoffrey Amherst after the defeat of the French. Years later, the land rights had still not been transferred, and John undertook the frustrating business of trying to sort it out for William.
Quebec, 26 May, 1803. My dear Lord, I expect to have some amusement in observing how the Jesuits' estate will be disposed of, for I have little doubt that it will be parcelled out to the hungry dependents of the government as speedily as a piece of horseflesh among a pack of hounds, and probably with nearly as much snarling and fighting. The Lower Province is very much in the situation of Ireland. The Catholics are very numerous, and I believe uniformly disaffected. It is to please them that the Jesuits' estate is kept in suspense. And if it be ever given up to them, it will operate as concession did in Ireland, by making them fancy themselves of more consequence and become more troublesome. There are many circumstances in the climate, the religion, and the feudal system, which will long prevent this lower part of Canada from feeling sufficient strength to think of independence. Yet it will happen sooner or later. There is the additional chance that France may someday make an attempt to recover her lost child. If ever a French armament appears, they will be joined by every man in the country. For the inhabitants of Canada are just as much French as the generation we found here. A French spy was apprehended here, and we have seen among his papers letters to his government telling them they could depend upon 40,000 fidèles Canadiens en bonnet rouge. Lord Dorchester used to call them faithful Canadians, and so they will prove themselves when occasion offers, but not in the sense he meant to convey.
Like most British officials, John was dubious about the Canadian commitment to the British cause. Professor Fernand Ouellette teaches at York University and is a leading authority on late 18th and 19th century French-Canadian history.
At this time, there were popular agitation. Then you have a situation where Francophone and Anglophone elite are more or less united against the popular agitation in Lower Canada, in Quebec, you know, at this time. And I think it's important to remind that since the conquest, there had been a lot of members of the English aristocracy or gentry who had bought seigneuries, then who had been integrated more or less, you know, in the fabric of the lower Canadian society. They have contributed to reinforce the aristocratic element in the society and aristocratic values and military values, because it was, formerly, it had been a military society.
The shaky interlude of the Peace of Amiens settled little. By the spring of 1803, Britain and France were at war again, and would remain so until Waterloo, a dozen years later. For several years, the colony had been adrift without a governor, and by 1807, the domestic tranquility at Quebec was on rocky ground. Rumors of an alliance between Napoleon's France and the United States had been circulating for months. Fears of conflict were heightened by the Chesapeake incident. An American ship had been stopped and searched for British deserters. That incident, in the summer of 1807, nearly led to war and increased the colony's trepidations. In the midst of all this fear and uncertainty, the military veteran Sir James Craig was appointed governor of the colony. Everyone breathed a little easier, and John's career got a boost.
December 16, 1807. My dearest brother, we are indebted to the Duke of Kent for our new appointment as Inspector of Provincial Accounts. He went to Sir James Craig the moment he heard he had been named Governor General. He recommended Mr. H. in the strongest terms and requested this place for Mr. H. as a favor to himself. In short, nothing can exceed his unremitting kindness to Mr. H. on all occasions.
As time passed, John and Elizabeth became increasingly preoccupied with the proper education of their sons, something they felt was not available in Quebec. They automatically looked to England. Elizabeth's brother, Lord Amherst, had been ambassador to the Sicilian court in Palermo, but he had returned to England and could keep an avuncular eye on the boys if they were at school there. He could also introduce them to the right people.
Quebec, 15 July, 1811. My dear Lord, my boys, I trust, will have arrived in England before this reaches you. I would not wish to have them favoured or petted, or ever to escape a flogging they deserve. I have not spared correction, and have used it severely for falsehood and disobedience. I hope they will not be found absolute savages, though in some respects they may not be very highly civilized. They would have become worse than Mohawks if we had kept them here, and this consideration reconciled us to a parting which otherwise was very painful.
January 23, my birthday. My dearest brother, your October letter mentions placing our boys at Kensington School, which we are thoroughly pleased with. The dear boys seem much pleased with their playmates, though Geoffrey begins by telling me the holidays are very near, which he believes he is to spend at his Uncle Amherst's. When they are all playing together on the lawn, does it not remind you frequently of former times? How we used to rejoice when you were coming home. I think Edward will have a turn for drawing, which I should like. It affords so much amusement and frequently may keep a young man out of mischief. I have seen many examples of it here where we have so many military. One young lad will amuse himself for hours at his own lodgings with drawing, while another, for want of occupation, throws away his time at a billiard table and gets a taste for gambling. Mr. H. has written to the Duke of Kent to say that the boys are gone to England and that you would take the first opportunity of presenting them to His Royal Highness. He will be anxious to see them, as he always writes most kindly about them. As you know, he is Edward's godfather.
Not all the Hale children were boys. They had three surviving daughters, but there was never any thought of them going to England to be educated. The girls stayed at home, and under their mother's guidance and training became well enough educated young women. Susan Houston.
Well, certainly in their social class, a concern for boys' education, and education in a slightly modern sense, in that you send a boy to a tutor or to a school or an academy, or perhaps even back to England in their case, was very common. It was not yet common for women of her class to send a daughter to an institution, to a school. You might have a tutor. You might go with two or three other little girls to the home of a gentlewoman who instructed. But to be instructed by your mother was not rare. And in fact, Elizabeth Amherst Hale seems to have been an extremely accomplished woman and probably was the best person that the girls could study with.
While the boys were at school and the girls were learning the womanly arts from Elizabeth, John Hale's career was advancing. He became a close advisor to the Lieutenant Governor, Sir James Craig. Craig led the so-called British Party at Quebec. It was in opposition to the Canadian Party, a group of mostly French-speaking colonists who wanted more control over local affairs. For a while, Craig proved a wily opponent for the Canadian Party, but he suffered from chronic edema and in 1811 sailed back to England, where he died within the year.
April 1811. My dearest brother, nothing can be more dismal than this town at present. Sir James's departure has put an end to a deal of bustling. He took away many officers, and the absence of our dear boys makes a sad blank. Our good friend General Brock is at Sorel, where he has most kindly invited us all to spend a fortnight. We have no reason to complain of our situation here. Our income is a very good one, and the situation very respectable. Indeed, now we are very great people, since Sir James Craig made Mr. H. a counsellor. Still, as you know, we cannot help hankering after old England, and more particularly when we think of being separated from our boys. My wish to return to England must now increase daily. After a 12 years' absence, it is not surprising that the maladie du pays should be felt with some force.
Quebec, 1 February 1812. My dear Lord, I thought 6 months ago that our women and children would all have been driven home. This does not now seem so near, more from the want of means than from any want of inclination in the American government to annoy us. Our legislature is to meet the 21st of this month to feel the pulse of our new chief, and I expect a stormy session. I wish I had never become one of these important lawgivers. Situated as I was with Sir James, it was impossible to decline. Should anything very ludicrous occur in this Senate of Lilliput, you shall hear.
The fear of war, always hovering in the background, once again began to seem more immediate. But this time, the enemy was the sprawling young republic to the south. Francophone reaction to war with the United States was confused. Quebec had frequently been a center for intrigues against the English, but when faced with the possibility of war with America, the Canadiens placed their support strongly behind the British crown. They had vivid and horrifying memories of Yankee looting and marauding during the American Revolution. The English establishment was just as worried about an American invasion.
29 June 1812, Quebec. My dearest brother, since I last wrote, we have received intelligence from New York that the question of war having passed both Senates, it only remained for the declaration to be made and the hostilities to begin. Some say the Americans will be at our gates in 6 weeks. Others, that it is impossible they can attack us this winter. I have made up my mind to be quite passive and do whatever Mr. H. may think best. We are very anxious to hear of our good friend General Brock, who is in Upper Canada with a small force. The coach has this moment come in from Montreal and brings us the declaration of war. So something must soon be decided.
What was decided was that Elizabeth would go home to England.
Quebec, 30 July, 1812. My dear Lord, your sister sailed on the 20th for Plymouth on the Neptune. I shall not attempt to describe to you the anxiety I have felt while her departure was under consideration, especially as her situation required a speedy decision. I am now satisfied that we have done right. The American army has crossed the strait between Lake Huron and Erie and is in possession of the town of Sandwich, about 10 miles from Fort Amherstburg. Other bodies of men are said to be in motion to fall upon different places, and I think that Upper Canada will very soon be in their possession. I send this down to catch the convoy and at the same time send some fresh provisions and bread.
As it turned out, Elizabeth would have been safe at Quebec. Most of the fighting took place in Upper Canada, where the Hales' good friend, Isaac Brock, was martyred at the Battle of Queenston Heights. Throughout her 4 years in England, Elizabeth worked tirelessly to find a good position for John at home. But with the world plunged into a serious economic depression, and all the heroes from 20 years of conflict waiting to be rewarded, there were simply too many office seekers and too few positions. John joined Elizabeth in England in 1815, but by the following spring, they decided their prospects were better in Canada and agreed to return. Neither of them ever saw England again. When they landed at Quebec this time, they looked at the New World not as a temporary posting, but as their permanent home. For John, this was a natural transition. Elizabeth found it more difficult, but she consoled herself by transferring her dynastic dreams from one side of the Atlantic to the other. She saw how this country could foster and enrich her children, and so she wholeheartedly took up the business of making the most of her new home.
July 17, 1819.
My dearest Lady A, for my own part, I consider America the rising country, and that our children, or grandchildren, will be very glad to have property here. In history, we find that as one country begins to decline, another rises, and generally to the westward, and I cannot but think that our children may see something of this kind during their lives. The lands are clearing in all directions, settlers arriving every day from Europe, almost entirely from England, Ireland, and Scotland. Farming is at present very little understood here, and a few intelligent Yorkshiremen would make an estate produce double what it does now. I have myself seen a new stable built on a farm, managed by Canadians, merely because the old one was quite filled with manure, and the only way they had of getting rid of it was burning the stable altogether. We used to see load after load of the finest manure emptied into the river because the farmers here declared that throwing it on the land spoilt it and only produced rank weeds.
While Elizabeth became enmeshed in domestic affairs, John finally began to enjoy the rewards of his years of dedication. He was appointed one of the commissioners charged with determining the precise boundary between Canada and the United States. The job paid £1,000 a year and gave him a chance to witness just how fast the colonies were growing.
Quebec, 21 July 1818. My dear Lord, I have escaped from the mosquitoes for a few weeks and arrived here 10 days ago. During my stay in Upper Canada, I passed through a part of the country the appearance of which seemed to me like magic. 26 years ago, I had seen the same country as uninterrupted forest, where now there are fine farms and stone houses of 2 stories, with occasionally flourishing villages. In one of these, Brockville, the land for buildings and gardens sold at the rate of £400 per acre, land which was purchased for 30 shillings an acre 15 years ago. On the opposite shores, the Americans also have some fine settlements, and a steamboat goes up and down each side of the river weekly. To what extent will this be increased when, by means of a canal, the falls of Niagara shall be surmounted?
John and Elizabeth Hale decided it was time to invest more than enthusiasm in this rising and potentially prosperous country. They determined to own a piece of it.
September 17, 1819. My dearest brother, this morning we have received a consent to buy the seigneury and domain of St. Anne de la Parade for £12,000. Those well acquainted with it think it well worth the sum. The seigneury is about 60 miles from Quebec and contains about 20 superficial leagues, together with islands, rights of hunting, fishing and ferrying, etc., etc. The domain contains 400 acres. It is considered the most valuable property, almost, in the province, with a house, barns, mills, and so forth. I am quite pleased with the purchase, as being so advantageous to our children. The seigneurial house is rather old, but will contain us. It only requires to be painted, and we shall perhaps, at our leisure, build a new one on another spot, leaving this for a farmer or perhaps one of our boys. Building is very cheap in that part of the country, and we have timber of our own and our own sawmills. The unconceded land amounts to 90,000 acres. A pretty little farm for a private gentleman. It will give us very nearly, if not quite, 5% now, and we expect much more in a very few years. And 90,000 acres would cut up into very pretty farms for the boys when it is all cleared and cultivated.
For the Hales, this pretty little farm was an obvious place to put down roots. John Hale, newly minted seigneur, was no beginner when it came to farming. He had grown up on his family's rural estate in Yorkshire, where he'd cultivated his own ideas about mixed farming, dairying, and harvesting wheat crops. Fernand Ouellet.
There were better seigneuries in the Three River District. But I think for him, the seigneurial system on one side, you know, produced prestige and, you know, it was very good for his aristocratic inclination. But in the same time, I think he must have been disappointed by the kind of income which was coming. Progressively, I think he adjusted, you know, to the milieu. The fact that he bought the seigneury of Saint-Anne-de-la-Pérade, I think it's not something unusual. It was something very frequent among the Anglophones, particularly since 1784, the Anglophone bourgeoisie had bought more or less massively, you know, seigneuries. Then I think it was not unusual, particularly because he was an aristocrat, but in the same time he was an aristocrat who was interested to look at the seigneury for its economic potential.
St. Anne's, 20 July, 1820. My dear Lord, I am busy here haymaking, and upon a small scale showing the Canadians the advantages of drill husbandry for turnips and of summer fallows. I have likewise astonished them with a haystack which was never seen here before. They house all this hay, tied up in bundles of 16 pounds, in which state it gets so dry that it is good for nothing after the first year.
When the hills arrived in Canada, the economy was just on the verge of a very important change of the timber trade as a result of the continental blockade, and in the same time the decline of the fur trade, which had been the dominant commercial activity since the beginning of the French regime. I think the society was also on the verge of adjusting to those changes. And it was a painful adjustment because in the agricultural sector, the agricultural economy had been based on the production of a single crop, which was wheat, and then wheat was on the verge also of declining. The politics, I think, was also affected by this change as well as the society. There was a decline of the nobility, and then the politics was started to be dominated by the emergence of new groups inside the French-Canadian society, the middle class, French-Canadian middle class. They had worked with the British in order to obtain parliamentary institutions. But after the beginning of the 19th century, as a result of economic changes and so on, and different problems, for example, the demographical pressure in the seigneuries, then, in fact, they emerged as a group which was no more interested, you know, to continue to work at the political level with the English middle class.
People here, particularly merchants, are all anxious about the lumber trade. Many are much out of spirits and say if the duty is taken off Baltic timber, it will be the death blow of Canada. Certainly, it must be of consequence to a vast number at Quebec and Montreal. But it may not be so pernicious to the country at large. When fewer men are employed in cutting down timber, they will turn more to the improvements of agriculture. Had we too large a population, it would be different. But there are such immense tracts of land unleased that it would be of more service to get them into cultivation. If the interests and consequence of Canada are not attended to ere long, she may be in the hands of the Yankees. That would be a sad blow to the pride of the mother country, for undoubtedly, this is a very thriving country. Quebec, 29 October, 1822. Dearest brother, I am just arrived from St. Anne's with all the family. Mr. Hale is remaining there a week longer on account of planting hedges. Petitions are making out for and against the Union of Upper and Lower Canada, both of which are more guided by private interest than public advantage. Should a distinction continue between the provinces,
May we not dread that if a difference of opinion should arise, the inhabitants of Upper Province might strengthen themselves with the assistance of their neighbours in the United States? A great part of the population is already American.
The petitions Elizabeth was writing about were for and against the Union Bill of 1822. It was aimed at anglicizing Lower Canada by joining it to Upper Canada. Under the terms of the Union Bill, English would become the official language of Parliament, and large property qualifications would effectively disenfranchise most French speakers. It would give the Crown more control over raising revenue, and would hobble the influence of the Roman Catholic Church. The bill was defeated in the British Parliament. But while their long-term future was being debated and decided elsewhere, the colony was in an uproar over a local scandal. The Receiver General had confessed that there wasn't a penny left in the public treasury. It was a complete disgrace for the Receiver General, but a surprising boon for the Hales. At last, 23 years after arriving in Quebec, 23 years after mentioning to his brother-in-law the very snug appointment upon which he would be very glad to lay his hands, John Hale achieved his goal.
Quebec, 20 December, 1823. My dearest brother, since I last wrote to you, the affairs of the Receiver General have come to a crisis, and Lord Dalhousie has in consequence been obliged to name another. His choice fell on Mr. Hale. He offered him the situation in the handsomest manner, saying it would relieve him from great difficulties if Mr. H. could accept it. At the same time, he assured Mr. Hale of his support with the Treasury, who must confirm the appointment.
John Hale had finally captured the appointment he had coveted for so long. And ironically, he had done it as much through his own efforts and well-deserved reputation as through any of the family's well-placed connections in England. But just when the Hales seemed destined to enjoy prosperity in this rising country, they were faced once again with a personal tragedy.
Quebec, 5 September, 1825. My dear Lord, I write you a few lines to mention that your sister, who has often complained of a pain in her side, is now threatened with an excessively hard tumour in one breast. For the present it has been checked by leeches, but I think the medical men apprehend that some surgical operation might be necessary. It is possible that the tumour has no connection with the pain in the side which he has felt for 20 years past. Quebec, 15 September, 1825. My dear Lord, I hope this letter will reach you as soon as my last letter, with the agreeable news that your sister's complaint has taken a very unexpected turn. Nothing of cancer exists, and no operation of any magnitude is likely to be required. A consultation of 5 of our best surgeons had seen her several times. Every preparation was made for removing the whole of the right breast, which was hard and distended to the utmost stretch of the skin, when 2 of the surgeons thought they perceived one small point which was rather softer than the rest. They proposed to try the lancet before they proceeded further. This was done, and the first touch produced an ejection which sprinkled the clothes of the attendants several feet from the bed. Nearly a pint of fluid was collected afterwards in a basin. The discharge was at first like pale yellow water and latterly tinged with red. The doctors have gently opened the puncture again daily for 5 successive days. Each time they have drawn off about a gill of the same sort of liquid. The breast is now reduced nearly to its natural size. The hardness is gradually disappearing, and we have every assurance that a cure will be effected, though it may yet require some time. The surgeons declare they have never seen or read of a similar case. After the first consultation upon the basin, Dr. Forbes, the chief of our medical staff, told me that he considered the discovery favourable. Then he added, "But I must confess to you that we are all abroad. It is a new case." 22 December, 1825, Quebec. My dear Lord, you will rejoice to hear that no fear seems now to exist of your sister's perfect cure. She suffered a copious and offensive discharge for nearly 3 months, without any diminution in the size of the tumor and with increasing signs of malignancy in the diseased part. An operation was at last determined upon, and on the 2nd of this month was carried into effect with apparent complete success. The wound is now nearly healed, and she is eating and drinking to recruit her strength.
Susan Houston.
You know, surgery at that time was a little better than butchery. Really, they didn't know what they were doing. You remember, we're more than a quarter century before Joseph Lister and the whole notion of antiseptic procedures in surgery. So, as I say, it must have been because she was so well connected and so well placed that they even attempted this operation. And she must have been in extremis before anyone would try it. And I think it would have been pretty awful.
Elizabeth died 6 months later, on the 18th of June, 1826. She was 52 years old. Modern medical opinion suggests she probably had breast cancer, certainly an abscess with an underlying malignancy, which the surgeons had failed to remove in its entirety. John Hale outlived his wife by a dozen years. He died in Quebec on Christmas Eve, 1838, much loved and revered by all who knew him. William Amherst returned to England from India in 1828, and largely retired from public affairs. By then, he had been created Earl Amherst of Arran. Most of the Hale boys, like their parents, were committed to Canada. Edward, the eldest, became an important politician and landowner in the eastern townships. Geoffrey, who served a time in the Royal Navy, returned to found the Quebec City Savings Bank. He left his fortune to establish Geoffrey Hale's Hospital, which is still operating in Quebec City. Other sons went into the law and the military. By contrast, the Hale girls all settled in England, one a spinster, another the wife of a clergyman, and the third married to an admiral. Montreal, the Amherst estate in Kent, is now a housing development with curious-sounding Canadian street names. The Hale Seigneurie, Saint-Anne-de-la-Parade, is now a tumble-down ruin in a St. Lawrence village best known for ice fishing. And their townhouse, with its airy situation overlooking Lower Town and the St. Lawrence, is no more. The site is now an empty lot.
On Ideas, you've been listening to The Rising Country, a program based on the letters of Elizabeth and John Hale. The program was prepared by Toronto writer Sandra Martin and historian Roger Hall, and the letters were read by Jill Frepier and Barry McGregor. A more complete collection of the Hales' letters, edited by Sidney Shelton and Roger Hall, will be published by the Champlain Society. This Ideas program was produced by Alison Moss, with technical production by Lorne Tulk, sound effects by Joe Hill, and production assistance by Liz Nodge. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Lister Sinclair.